Continuing. In 1963, the agency masterminded a revolution in Honduras, another in the Dominican Republic, and a third in Guatemala. In 1964, it assisted in General Branco's military coup in Brazil. In 1965, the Special Forces joined U.S. Marines in suppressing civil war in the Dominican Republic. And in 1966, the CIA aided and abetted Colonel Onganía's military coup in Argentina. Cuba was an especially hot number in 1965. Led by JM Wave personnel, the CIA had planned a new invasion of the island to follow one of its attempts to assassinate Castro. The planners included Howard Hunt and James McCord. Unlike the Bay of Pigs invasion, this time the agency was offering leadership in addition to training and financing. However, one byproduct of the 1965 intervention in the Dominican Republic was the aborting of the plan to invade Cuba. Skipping down. When J.M. Wave was dismantled, Theodore Shackley and his staff left Miami for Laos, leaving behind a highly trained army of 6,000 fanatically anti-communist Cubans allied to organized crime and powerful elements of the U.S. right. In 1966, following the Tricontinental Congress, which proceeded without Ben Barka, this is because Ben Barka was assassinated, by the way, a counterfront, the World Anti-Communist League, WACL, was chartered in Seoul, South Korea, by hardline reactionaries from the world over. That same year, Agenter Press, sponsored by WACL and the intelligence agencies of the United States, France, and Portugal, was created in Lisbon as a cover-up for OAS terrorists, as a cover for OAS terrorists and other European fascists. Led by the Frenchman Yves Guérin-Sarac, its aim was the subversion through espionage, sabotage, and murder of all that the Tricontinental Congress had stood for. In that same period, Cuban exile activist organizations sprouted all over Miami's Little Havana. They spawned, in turn, terrorist subgroups like Alpha 66 and Omega 7, whose more notorious leaders, Guillermo and Ignacio Novo, Orlando Bosch, and Nazario Serquen, had all been trained by the CIA. Between 65 and 71, they staged sporadic acts of sabotage and assassinations, with Guillermo Novo repeatedly arrested only to be released each time. Cubans, terrorists among them, were also being paid by Santo Traficante and the Syndicate to help spin their intricate U.S. narcotics web. And they also found the time for dirty tricks on behalf of Richard Nixon and his White House staff. However, incidents like Operation Eagle of 1970, when the BNDD rounded up Cuban exile drug traffickers and found many to have been trained by the CIA, had made the Cubans an increasing embarrassment to the agency. As the 70s began, the CIA's Cubans had become an angry, confused, and divided lot, who felt betrayed by their former employer. Still, they experienced a comeback midway through 1971, when the powers that be, creep in the four, of course that was Nixon's committee to re-elect the president, when the powers that be, creep in the four, again sought their services. And in 1973, with the military in power in Chile, they found a new employer in the ruthless Chilean secret police, DINA, D-I-N-A. Other dictators south of the border have since followed suit.
Continuing. In 1974-75, a reign of terror struck Miami's Cuban community as opponents of Orlando Bosch were liquidated. The campaign continued well into 1976, during which Miami was rocked by over 700 bombings. And that year, there was a notable upsurge in Cuban exile activity beyond the territorial U.S. On April 6th, two Cuban fishing boats were attacked and destroyed, and one fisherman was killed. On April 22nd, a bomb exploded at Cuba's Lisbon embassy, killing two and seriously wounding several others. In June of 1976, in the Dominican Republic town of Bonao, the Cuban action movement, the Cuban National Liberation Front, Brigade 2506, F-14, and the Cuban Nationalist Movement merged as Bosch's Coordination of United Revolutionary Organizations, or CORU, C-O-R-U. On July 5th, a bomb exploded at the office of Cuba's UN delegation. On July 9th, another went off at Kingston Airport in Jamaica in baggage about to be loaded onto a Havana-bound Cuban flight. The next day, there was an explosion at the Bridgetown Barbados office of British West Indian Airways, which also represented Cubana de Aviación. On July 17th, bombs went off in the Cuban airline office and embassy in Bogota, Colombia. On July 23rd, a Cuban technician was killed in Merida, Mexico, trying to stop the abduction of the Cuban attaché. On August 9th, terrorists kidnapped two diplomats assigned to the Cuban embassy in Buenos Aires. On August 18th, a bomb exploded at the Cubana de Aviación office in Panama. On September 21st, Chile's former Secretary of State, Orlando Letelier, and his co-worker, Ronnie Carpen Moffat, were killed in Washington when a bomb decimated their car. On October 6th, yet another explosion gutted a Cuban airliner off Barbados, killing 73. Interrupting here, remember that bombing of the Cuban airliner. We're going to touch right back on that in a second. On November 7th, one exploded at the Cubana de Aviación office in Madrid. Finally, on November 9th, kidnappers seized an Argentine employee of the Buenos Aires Cuban embassy. Orlando Bosch's army of anti-Castro Cuban terrorists was responsible for all these acts. When the Cuban airliner went down, Bosch himself was arrested in Venezuela. But the extremists had not waited until 1976 to take part in international terrorist operations. In 1975, 100 anti-Castro Cubans joined European fascists in the Army for the Liberation of Portugal, or ELP. From neighboring Spain, the ELP, whose core comprised Agenter Press OAS veterans, attempted to overthrow Portugal's progressive military regime. The 1975 attempt in Rome on the life of Chilean Christian Democratic Party leader Bernardo Leighton was a joint action of DINA, the youth wing of the Italian Fascist Party, MSI, and anti-Castro Cubans. The 1976 murder of Letelier and Moffat, a Dino Carew job, was planned in Miami. Four of the five Cubans involved in it were CIA veterans of the Bay of Pigs invasion. The Leighton attempt and Letelier murder were each coordinated by the American Chilean DINA agent, Michael Townley.
All right. Well, you will remember, of course, the bombing of the Cuban airliner, of course, particularly tragic case. Many, many people killed. Most of them, I think all of them, in fact, civilians, some of them members of the Cuban fencing team, I believe, or athletes, quite a few of them athletes. Anyway, blown up out of the sky by Carew and by Orlando Bosch's team, but by one particular person who was involved, who we find very interesting at this point in time. Remember, we've been talking about these things, again, quite a few things that happened in the past, and one, of course, who tuned this broadcast in knowing that it was about the Iran-Contragate hearings might be asking, yeah, so what? Well, we're going to talk about one of the so whats right now. This is an article from the San Jose Mercury News for Thursday, October 16th, 1986. The article is headlined, Contra Figure Linked to Jet Bombing. The article is by Tim Golden, Knight Ridder News Service, Dateline Managua, Nicaragua. Sandinista security officials said Wednesday that a Cuban exile, who allegedly helped run an El Salvador-based Contra supply operation, is an escapee from a Venezuelan jail where he was being held for the 1976 bombing of a Cuban jetliner. Deputy Interior Minister Luis Carrion said Sandinista officials are convinced that Ramon Medina, identified by a captured U.S. pilot as the number two figure in the Contra supply operation, is, in fact, Luis Posada Carriles, spelled C-A-R-R-I-L-E-S, one of four suspects, including Orlando Bosch, charged in the Cubana airliner bombing that claimed 73 lives. Posada Carriles escaped from prison last year. Carrion said at a news conference Wednesday in Managua that Eugene Hassenfuss, the American captured 2 weeks ago, had identified Posada from photographs shown him by interrogators. He also cited other unidentified Sandinista intelligence sources he said indicated that Medina and Posada were the same person. Quote, we are certain that it's him, Carrion said. Skipping down in the article, Posada Carriles was arrested in Venezuela a few weeks after a bomb exploded in a Cubana Airlines DC-8 shortly after it took off from Barbados on October 6, 1976, heading for Havana. A naturalized Venezuelan, Posada had worked for Venezuelan military intelligence. Venezuelan authorities accused Posada and Bosch, a Cuban exile whose case has become a cause celebre in some exile circles, as the, quote, intellectual authors of the bombing. Posada Carriles escaped August 18, 1985, from a national penitentiary in San Juan de los Morros, 60 miles southwest of Caracas. Venezuela's justice minister told reporters after the escape that Posada had bribed a prison guard supervisor. Venezuelan press accounts put that payoff as high as $25,000, a sum financed, according to unconfirmed Venezuelan reports, by an anti-Castro group. Posada's presence in Central America had been announced over Miami radio stations late last year. Tomas Regalado, general news editor at WQBA radio station, said Posada's associates distributed a taped message from Posada to WQBA and other Spanish language stations, in which he said he had escaped from jail because he expected no justice in Venezuela. Posada also said he was, quote, fighting communism in Central America, unquote. Now, again, remember that this fighting communism in Central America, that Posada Carriles, the man who the Sandinistas seem to think, and in fact we seem to think too, was involved in the bombing of the Cubana de Aviación airliner, taking 73 lives, is fighting communism, just happens to be running a El Salvador-based Contra Supply Network, according to Eugene Hassenfuss, a man who ought to know.
Many many sources have since confirmed this particular account. This came out relatively early in the series of revelations about this scandal. Now, one of the things to remember, again, is Carriles' participation in the Air Cubana bombing. Another thing to remember, and as we analyze the Carew wave of terror here, and bearing in mind its connections to JM Wave, its origins going back to JM Wave, headed by Theodore Shackley, its intersection with the Santo Traficante Cuban Mafia, one of the things to remember now is that while this particular wave of terror in which Posada Carriles participated in was at the head of the CIA at that time was none other than George Bush. In our last broadcast, George Bush's name emerged in a big way. In fact, one fellow, Jesus Garcia, revealed that, quote, the Contra supply operation was, quote, George Bush's baby, unquote. We're going to take a musical break here in just a second, but bearing in mind the Posada-Carriles connection to the Air Cubana bombing and the Carew wave of terror, George Bush's heading up of the CIA at this time, it's worth interjecting and pondering the following material. Going back now to the great heroin coup by Henrik Krueger. The common denominator in Carew, as well as Internacional Fascista, a combine of anti-communist extremist organizations chartered at an October 1976 meeting in Rome attended by Carew representatives, appears to have been the CIA, or at least a faction thereof. Carew's headquarters are in Miami. Originally, it was sustained by tight collaboration with the CIA and the Chilean junta's secret police. According to the Cuban former CIA agent Manuel Darmas, the CIA coordinated Dina's acts with Carew's and supplied the latter with funds, advisors, and explosives. We're going to take a music break now, and we're going to come back as we take a look at some more players in the Carew terror team, coordinated by either the CIA or an element thereof, at that time headed by George Bush. And we're going to take a look specifically at connecting links between the Iran-Contra operation and the assassination of Orlando Letelier, probably the biggest and bloodiest feather in the cap of the Carew warriors.
So don't go away. This is Nip Tuck. Dave Emery and myself will return in just a few minutes with more of Radio Free America right here on a rather extended musical break, but that's okay. Give you all a chance to get up and run around and shake off some of the fear and loathing inspired by the kind of stuff that we tend to present on the broadcast. What can we do, folks? We are a mirror of reality, and we can only show what is shown to us. So we have been talking, of course, tonight. For those of you who just tuning in and just heard a long extended musical thing and don't know what's going on, of course, this is Radio Free America. This is the, it's a Sunday night. It's usually one step beyond. However, because of some scheduling glitches of various sorts, we are doing Radio Free America tonight. It's the second part of our series on the Iran / Contragate hearings. Last time we dealt with the drug connections. Tonight we are dealing with the terror connections, although, as we have said several times during the course of the broadcast, they are inextricable in many ways. And as Dave put it, these are largely academic separations that we are making for the sake of, if nothing else, ease in tape filing. So we've been talking tonight about the origins, among other things, the origins of the JM Wave station in Miami, that from the early 1960s, 61 in its founding, helped to bring together a lot of disparate elements of the the anti-communist right and syndicate, the organized crime syndicate, the drug traffic and things like that, all under the auspices of the CIA. And many of the characters who were involved in JM Wave, such as Theodore Shackley, Thomas Kleins et al., are still with us today as part of Iran-Contragate. And in fact, Iran-Contragate, as we are demonstrating tonight, is only part, only the most recent face put on a decades-long terrorist war, essentially against the democratic principles of the United States.
Some of the key names that we've looked at in the broadcast: Robert Vesco, Santo Trafficante, Carew, Orlando Bosch, William Casey, who, of course, headed up the original investigation slash cover-up into Vesco vis-a-vis the SEC, and Mr. Posada Carriles, a fellow who was in the Carew CIA wave of terror, George Bush being CIA director at the time. We're going to come now to a couple of other very, very important names. We're going to look at some intersections now between the bloodiest and most, well, perhaps not the bloodiest in terms of number of victims, but the most successful and celebrated of the many Carew assassinations, the Trafficante shooters team link to this whole milieu that we're talking about, and the information we presented at Radio's Free America's 26 and 27, as well as some of the review of the Trafficante JM Wave Theodore Shackley connections in the last of our programs, Radio RFA number 29. Two key names now that we're going to take a look at in connection with the Iran-Contra scandal. Then we're going to take a look at least one of their participations in the assassination of Orlando Letelier. And we're going to tie in the Letelier assassination with some of the players in the Iran-Contra scandal right now. The following article is from the San Jose Mercury of October 15th of 1986. Research credit on this to Ted Rubenstein, an excellent researcher who's been working with us for some time. This is a Washington Post story, Dateline Washington, headlined, Web of U.S. Contra Violations Alleged in Senator's Staff Report. Senator John F. Kerry, Democrat of Massachusetts, outlined allegations Tuesday from more than 50 sources that he said raised, quote, serious questions about whether the United States has abided by the law, unquote, in its relations with Nicaraguan rebels known as Contras over the past 3 years. Skipping down in the story, the report said most weapons shipments to Contra bases at Aguacate and La Ceiba, C-E-I-B-A, in Honduras, quote, were allegedly conducted from the Dominican Republic, unquote. It said sources named a Frank or Francisco Chanez, C-H-A-N-E-S, a Cuban-American in the seafood business in Miami, as a major financial backer and arms supplier for Contra operations in southern Nicaragua, and linked him to Frank Castro, C-A-S-T-R-O, an unindicted co-conspirator in the narcotics ring purchase of the Sunshine Bank of Florida last year. The sources also alleged that a Chanez bank account received more than $206,000 in U.S. humanitarian aid funds this year. Repeated calls to Chanez went unanswered. Key names, of course, the aforementioned Frank or Francisco Chanez, also known as Paco in the Sheehan affidavit that we're about to touch on, and Frank Castro. More on both individuals, their roles in the Iran-Contra scandal, and Frank Castro's role in the assassination of Orlando Letelier, coming up.
Now, again, bear in mind, as we said, that the connection between the drug networks and the terror networks in many cases are not only indistinguishable, they're one and the same. But what's very important for our purposes here is also to note that these people are involved in the terror networks to begin with, also the drug networks, because, again, we're talking about Iran-Contragate. We are daily faced in the news media with a parade of people professing their patriotism. That's a lot of P's. But a parade of people talking about Ollie North, what a great guy. Richard Secord talking about how, you know, he didn't do it for profits, he did it for patriotism. Again, folks, the word they're using, when they're using the word patriotism, they're talking about things that most of us would talk about and we would call terrorism and drug smuggling.
Recalling the phrase that patriotism is the last refuge of a scoundrel.
Indeed. We're going to read to you a little bit here from the Daniel Sheehan affidavit, which is a supplement to the actual suit filed by the Christic Institute on behalf of Tony Avergan and Martha Honey. Significant here, as we've talked about in the past, Tony Avergan was badly wounded in the La Penca press conference bombing, in which Eden Pastora, the former Comandante Cero of one of the anti-Sandinista groups, himself a former Sandinista, was giving a press conference. Comandante Cero, Aiden Pastora, had been resisting the incorporation of his group by the CIA-funded Contras. Remember, we're talking about CIA-funded Contras who are also dealing in drugs and illegal weapons and committing acts of terrorism. Aiden Pastora, whatever his true political beliefs are, had definite reservations about putting his group together with this other group. There was a massive explosion at the La Penca press conference. Several people were killed. Many reporters were injured. Aiden Pastora himself was badly injured. One of the reporters, Tony Avergan, along with his wife, another reporter, both for NPR, Martha Honey, put together a lawsuit with the help of the Christic Institute and the Christic Institute's chief counsel, Daniel Sheehan. That is, in fact, the affidavit we're going to be dealing with tonight at some length. Here's a small portion. That's why the legal language, but they're talking again about Paco Chanes, who Dave just mentioned, and some other folks, including John Hall, an American expatriate with links to John Singlob and the World Anti-Communist League, and through him directly to the Reagan administration.
And again, we used this affidavit in our last broadcast. We'll be coming back to it throughout the course of the series.
Reading from the Sheehan affidavit on page 30. In early 1986, plaintiff's counsel established contact with source number 54, a man actively engaged in the trafficking of cocaine with defendant Francisco Paco Chanes and defendant Dagoberto Nunes, which source communicated to plaintiff's counsel detailed information confirming the participation of defendants Chanes, Nunes, and Hall, remember that's John Hall, in the smuggling of cocaine into the United States through Miami and Memphis. Source number 54 supplied plaintiff's counsel with the names and whereabouts of some half dozen pilots who flew guns, ammunition, and C4 explosives from the United States to John Hull's ranch in Costa Rica, and who flew cocaine back into the United States from defendant Hull's ranch. A number of these pilots have been located and contacted by plaintiff's counsel, but they insist upon immunity from criminal prosecution in exchange for their testimony against the defendants in this case. The pilots constitute sources 54 through 59. So again, the Sheehan affidavit is talking about one of the people who had been himself involved in the cocaine trafficking coming forward to act as a source, naming Paco Chanes, Francisco Chanes, Chanes, defendant Dagoberto Nunes, and John Hall. Remember, John Hall linked, heavily linked to John Singlob, General John Singlob, and the World Anti-Communist League. Naming all three of these men as being direct core participants in the exchange of guns and ammunition for drugs in the United States. Taking drugs in the United States, exchanging them for guns, and taking them back to Latin America and the Contras.
Recall, we went over some of the names in this. Names Mike Tolliver, Gary Betzner, quite possibly also George Morales, a speedboat racer, are a couple of the names I would be willing to bet, without having access to their files, that those are three of those sources just named there. But again, remember Francisco Paco Chanes, his role in the Iran-Contra operation, or the Contra supply effort, I should say. It doesn't have anything to do with Iran, at least not as far as we've been able to determine so far. And also his association in this effort with one Frank Castro. We're going to learn more now about Frank Castro and his role in the aforementioned assassination of Orlando Letelier, his participation in the Kourou CIA-directed operation, the Kourou Milieu, right now. Reading from another book, or reading from a book about the assassination of Orlando Letelier, it's called Assassination on Embassy Row. It's by John Dinges, D-I-N-G-E-S, and Saul Landau, L-A-N-D-A-U, published in hardcover by Pantheon Books of New York, copyright 1980. Out of Frank Castro, his participation in Kourou, and his merging of his own organization with Kourou, the authors write as follows. And again, bearing in mind the Kourou milieu's involvement with the assassination of Orlando Letelier. In early June, Miami buzzed with rumors about a large group of exile heavies converging on Bonao, a mountain resort town in the Dominican Republic. The alleged organizers of the meeting were Bosch and Frank Castro, a Cuban exile who had married into an influential Dominican-based family. The meeting ended in mid-June with a consensus for action and the formation of a new group, Kourou, the Commando of United Revolutionary Organizations. Word reached Miami that Kourou, which sounds in Spanish like a rooster's crow, had an impressive membership. Although Bosch's minuscule Cuban action group was listed first, Kourou included the leaders of the Bay of Pigs Veterans Brigade 2506, the largest and most respected of the exile groups, With almost 1,000 active members, Frank Castro's Cuban National Liberation Front and Felipe Rivero's CNM, groups that claimed adherence with long action records. And I would interrupt, of course, we looked at Brigade 2506, Felix Rodriguez, his involvement with this entire team from the date of the shooters team put together by Traficante, and his connections to George Bush.
Now, again, the assassination of Orlando Letelier is rather interesting for our purposes for a variety of reasons. One of them is that this is another one of the set of major crimes that brings together several of the principals in this JM Wave operation, or what was originally the JM Wave operation, and brings them together in interesting and odd ways.
Yeah, again, JM Wave was the Miami station back in the early 60s, as we looked at not only in our last broadcast on the subject, but in Radio Free America shows 26 and 27. That same team stuck together and has continued to operate. Just by way of clarification, JM Wave itself disappeared, but Nip quite correctly has pointed out that the same team remained together. So in a sense, the JM Wave rolled around the world.
Yes, indeed. One of the interesting things about the death of Orlando Letelier, the man who had been formerly second, basically the right-hand man to Salvador Allende, had been badly mistreated in Colonia Dignidad in Chile after the 1973 CIA-aided coup down there, had come to Washington and was essentially the sort of Banquo's ghost at the feast as far as the Chilean military junta went, because he was in Washington with his group very publicly speaking about the crimes of the Chilean military and not coincidentally about the crimes of the CIA and helping to bring the Chilean military junta to power. Orlando Letelier was blown up with a car bomb in downtown Washington, D.C., right in the heart of the beast. And what's interesting about the case, well, a variety of things interesting about the case. One of the most interesting is that at the time of Letelier's death and the subsequent cover-up, which was very intense and very sophisticated, the man in charge of the CIA, the director of the CIA, was our own Vice President George Bush, a man who not insignificantly has been hovering in the background of the entire Iran-Contragate hearing and would be himself probably strongly implicated at this point in several of the drugs aspect of it were not for the death of Stephen Carr, detailed in our last show.
He should be hovering in the foreground, but one of the aspects we're going to be coming up to in our last broadcast is that, in fact, the most important aspects of the case have been submerged. But George Bush's name emerged repeatedly in our last broadcast on the subject, people referring to the Contra supply effort as George Bush's baby, the many, many references by various people involved in the drug smuggling that we've touched back on in this program went back to George Bush as the ultimate prime mover in this situation.
We're going to read a little short segment right now from a book that we've used quite a bit on these broadcasts. Death in Washington, The Murder of Orlando Letelier by Donald Freed with Dr. Fred Landis. And this book was published in hardcover by Lawrence Hill and Company, copyright 1980. Now, the person that they're referring to as Townley is a man by the name of Michael Vernon Townley. Townley is interesting because he was holding a rank in the Chilean DINA, the Chilean secret police, and was himself apparently the practical mastermind of the assassination of Orlando Letelier. But Townley himself was an American, part of a CIA-linked family in Chile. And interestingly enough, the ties of the CIA into the Chilean secret police's assassination of Orlando Letelier are very strong, and that was one of the reasons that George Bush had to work so hard when he was the DCIA to cover up the connections and why he had to bring in all of his assets, people like Buckley, Arno de Borgrov et al., to try and miscast the truth. Anyway, we're going to hear another rather significant name for our purposes linked with Townley from Free and Landis's death in Washington. Michael Townley, now holding a rank equivalent to lieutenant colonel in the DINA, flew into New York City on September 9, 1976. According to the prosecutor at the trial, he brought 10, quote, electric matches, unquote, or blasting caps with him. But there is strong evidence that the caps came from a former CIA man, Edwin Wilson, a man who deals in the shipment of explosive devices. This information would plague the FBI during its murder investigation. A bunch of things interesting about Wilson's connections. We're going to be talking more about Ed Wilson later on because the La Penca bombing just mentioned, which is the cause for the Sheehan affidavit and the entire Avergan honey suit being pushed by the Christic Institute, the La Penca bombing was apparently brought off by a man who was in fact recruited by Ed Wilson and Frank Turple, and they're in their Libyan, their days of glory in Libya with Muammar Gaddafi.
In fact, one of the what the Letelier assassination represents in terms of its significance in this broadcast is really the transition to a large, long discussion on the Wilson team. For years on these broadcasts, and Mae Russell for even longer, we have been talking about the Turple Wilson team and its significance, its connections, its prime role in instituting terror around the world. In particular, terror which is made out to look like left-wing terror, and which then serves, as we've cited so often, as the pretext for the restriction of civil liberties at home and military expansionism abroad. We're going to be taking a look at the Turple Wilson team, both in this and the next broadcast. Some Radio Free America references, which you can go to in order to get information on Turple Wilson. Need Death in Washington up there. No.
Oh, okay.
There we go. But some Radio Free American references. Radio Free America number 4, of course, which focused on the Turple Wilson team specifically. We came back to the Turple Wilson team in our series on the Pope shooting. We touched back on them yet again in our per Radio Free America program number 22. We looked at the Turple Wilson, or we looked at Edwin Wilson, his involvement with the Nugenhan Bank, among other things, in Radio Free America number 25, and at the end of our last broadcast, the first of our Iran-Contra programs, Radio Free America number 29. And Edwin Wilson has been involved, as we said, in just about every major intelligence operation since he in the last 25 years, including the assassination of Orlando Letelier. We're going to go back to the Wilson role and his cohort Frank Turple's role in the assassination of Orlando Letelier right now. And we're going to bring up a name which is very important. We're going to follow up with more detail on this particular name, but a person we're going to come back to in the next broadcast as well, a man named J. Stanley Pottinger. Reading once again from Death in Washington. Townley met with Frank Turple once a week. Townley met with Frank Turple 1 week before the Letelier murder, on the same day that he met with Senator James Buckley and aides in New York City. The explosives sent into the United States on Chilean Airlines were to replace explosives supplied by Edwin Wilson, according to a source close to the office of Assistant U.S. Attorney Lawrence Barcella, Jr. Barcella, B-A-R-C-E-L-L-A, had worked with Eugene Proper on the Letelier-Moffett case. Each increment of American involvement in the crime leads to the threshold question. What did George Bush and the CIA know, and when did they know it? On October 4, 1976, DCI Bush, that's Director of Central Intelligence Bush, met with Eugene Proper and J. Stanley Pottinger, P-O-T-T-I-N-G-E-R, and promised cooperation in exchange for FBI caution in any national security matters. Then, on November 8th, Bush flew to Miami on the pretext of a walking tour of Little Havana, unquote. Actually, he met with the Miami FBI special agent in charge, Julius Mattson, and the chief of the anti-Castro terrorism squad. According to a source close to the meeting, Bush warned the FBI against allowing the investigation to go any farther than the lowest level Cubans. This was a secret meeting, but publicly Bush was selling headlines like "Left is also suspect in slaying of Letelier" to Jeremiah O'Leary in the Washington Star. And just the week before, on November 1st, the Washington Post had quoted both Bush and Kissinger to the effect that the junta was not involved. This is obstruction of justice and misprision of a felony at the least. Why would the director of the American Central Intelligence Agency violate the law in the interests of the Chilean junta? So again, the Turple Wilson connection to the assassination of Orlando Letelier, the role of J. Stanley Pottinger and George Bush in covering up the CIA's connections to this assassination are to be thought about here. And J. Stanley Pottinger is a very interesting fellow. We're going to be coming back to him, as I said, in the third part of our Radio Free America series on Iran-Contragate.
Right now we have a little bit more about Pottinger and DCIA George Bush et al. This is from Labyrinth, originally copyright 1982, written by Eugene M. Proper and Taylor Branch, published in 82 by Viking Press.
Proper being one of the people who helped prosecute the killers of Letelier.
That's right. And the he being referred to at the beginning of this is, in fact, Eugene Proper, who has just been, who's on the case and is investigating the assassination of Orlando Letelier and the murky series of connections between the people apparently involved. The next day, Proper received a call from Stanley Pottinger. Assistant Attorney General in charge of the Civil Rights Division of the Justice Department. Pottinger introduced himself over the phone and said he had been speaking with representatives of the Institute for Policy Studies, who thought the Civil Rights Division should take over the Letelier case because of its political overtones. The Civil Rights Division offered certain advantages, said Pottinger, through statutes that made murder a federal crime as a violation of civil rights. What did Proper think? Instantly guarded, Proper replied that he already had ample federal jurisdiction through the Protection of Foreign Officials Act, whose murder and conspiracy provisions carry maximum life sentences. In addition, he had two counts of first-degree murder and numerous related charges. The Civil Rights Division could prosecute none of these offenses, nor could its statutes bring to bear such severe penalties. At this, Pottinger retreated a bit, saying he had not realized that Letelier was covered by the foreign officials law. It would be better for the U.S. Attorney's Office to hit the killers with the full weight of murder charges. Pottinger added that he wanted Proper to know that he and the Civil Rights Division were eager to help in any way they could. Proper thanked him. It was time to be gracious, and Pottinger's offer of assistance clicked with the problem on Proper's mind. He was thinking of the rain and the intimidating CIA building. He had just been left standing out in the rain trying to get into the CIA building in the passage just before this. So he told Pottinger he was afraid he would not get cooperation from the agency. Did Pottinger have any ideas? Instant, warm confidence shot through the telephone line. The assistant attorney general replied that he happened to be a personal friend of the CIA director himself, George Bush. Pottinger called him George. For him, the CIA director was only a phone call away. Would Proper like an appointment? By that afternoon, he, meaning Proper, Kornick and Pottinger were scheduled for lunch with Director Bush at CIA headquarters on Monday. A Justice Department limousine would pick them up at noon. Proper whistled to himself. This was known in Washington as access.
And, of course, the J. Stanley Pottinger role in coordinating his good friend George Bush's contacts with the Department of Justice should be borne in mind here. The fact that J. Stanley Pottinger is an associate of a man named Cyrus Hashemi, we're going to deal with at considerable length in the next broadcast. And, of course, devotees of this program, people familiar with our archives, will recall that J. Stanley Pottinger, for 9 years, was Gloria Steinem's lover, Steinem herself, with many, many CIA contacts. So J. Stanley Pottinger, one of the names to bear in mind for future reference. Now, again, the point that we're making here is that the Triple Wilson team is the team that we're looking at in Iran-Contragate. Nip's going to read you an article which will sum that up rather nicely.
This is from the New York Times for Thursday, June 18, 1987. The headline, Ex-CIA Official May Link C-Cord to Disloyal Agent. They should, by the way, put disloyal in quotation marks. Man who smuggled arms to Libya reportedly had ties with retired general. The article is by Fox Butterfield, a special to the New York Times, Dateline Washington, June 17th. A retired CIA official is expected to tell Congress next week of a financial link between Major General Richard V. Secord, a key figure in the Iran-Contra affair, and Edwin P. Wilson, the renegade CIA agent convicted of smuggling arms to Libya, according to congressional investigators. In addition, the investigators said, several Defense Department employees will testify that some senior Pentagon officials, apparently including Defense Secretary Caspar W. Weinberger, knew about the secret arms sales to Iran in 1985, well before President Reagan approved them in a presidential, quote, finding in January of 86. Mr. Weinberger has insisted that he did not know anything about the transfer of American-made TOW anti-tank and Hawk anti-aircraft missiles to Tehran until President Reagan secretly authorized them in early 1986. The testimony by the Pentagon employees and the former CIA official Glenn Robinette, R-O-B-I-N-E-T-T-E, is to come when the congressional committees investigating the Iran-Contra affair resume their hearings. He will indicate that though Mr. Wilson has been under arrest since 1982, a network of former CIA agents and military officers he helped establish to sell American arms abroad has continued, the investigators say. In fact, according to investigators, Mr. Wilson's ring formed much of the structure for the private foreign policy, selling weapons to Iran and providing money to the Contras that was run out of the White House by Lieutenant Colonel Oliver L. North. Okay, a couple of points to be made real quickly. First of all, although we're not going to go into it in great depth tonight, I personally would like to take issue with this concept that this ring was run out of the White House by Oliver North. Although Oliver North has not yet testified, and this has not all yet received the sanction of the official press, this is the way it is, kind of a routine. Let's make something clear. Oliver North worked for most of these people throughout a large portion of his career. He has been a subsidiary, I guess. It's not the right term, but anyway, he's a subordinate, excuse me, of people like Theodore Shackley et al. He has, in fact, worked for them. What Oliver North was, as far as I can tell, and I probably speak for Dave in this too, is he was the liaison to the White House. He was not, in fact, the mastermind of this plot, because this plot and others like it have been going on since long before Oliver North reached the position that he has recently gotten himself into in the White House. Secord, Kleins, Ed Wilson, this whole gang, Shackley, have been doing this for years and years. Ed Wilson, for reasons that we are still not sure, probably got on the wrong side of somebody or went too far to the point where he could no longer be covered as an asset any longer and was essentially, it looks, thrown to the wolves. He is now apparently providing some information to the Christic Institute suit, perhaps as by way of getting revenge. Because what Wilson did in Libya, as we will touch on briefly tonight, what Wilson did with Frank Turpin in Libya is exactly what Shackley, Kleins et al. Have been doing with Nicaragua and Iran. But for one reason or another, Wilson got in a situation where he was no longer protected. But to suggest that what he did was different and he was bad and these other guys were good, or to suggest that Oliver North was the mastermind, is a complete error, and that's something that has to be straightened out.
Yeah, the major point of that article, however, is that this is the Triple Wilson team involved in the Iran-Contra scandal. As Wilson indicated, the team he put together stayed together, and the family that stays together plays together.
And slays together.
And the kinds of games, you took the words right out of my mouth, the kinds of games they play are very, very lethal for the people they play against. But again, the key point of that article, and one which is going to be developed further in a number of other stories to follow, the team we're looking at in the Iran-Contra scandal is the Ed Wilson team, the Wilson-Turple team. This is why we have focused on it so heavily over the years. This is the single, probably, if you had to start with one particular element, the Turple Wilson team is the single most important element in the U.S. intelligence apparatus.